ahead and pick the speed up. Your number one now, runway 27, clear to land green dot. Welcome to Oshkosh, guys.
Hello and welcome to The Green Dot, EAA's podcast for anyone and everyone who loves aviation. The Green Dot is sponsored by Crew Chief Systems, the smarter way to manage, maintain, and safeguard your aircraft's value. I'm Tom Charpentier, Government Relations Director and one of your hosts, and across.
I'm Chris Henry. I'm the Museum Manager here in Oshkosh, and today we're talking with a special guest, someone who flew one of my all-time favorite airplanes. Tom, I think you have a soft spot for this aircraft as well. And we are talking about the A6 Intruder, and we're here with pilot Dick Kohler, who actually flew these aircraft. Dick, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Dick, I think you'd also be very familiar to anybody who's looked at hints for home builders, been to our Sport Air workshops and stuff like that. You've done a lot of work with educating home builders about building their aircraft.
Thank you. I was just reminiscing about that the other day. It's been 35 years we've been doing it. So, yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Well, and by the way, it's Tom's fault you're here, because one time I was lamenting that I wish I could find an A6 pilot to come and talk, and without missing a beat, he's like, why don't you just get Dick Kohler? Like, he's an A6 pilot.
So. Yeah, years and years ago, well, not years and years, about 10 years ago, Dick and I worked together on building our staff-built Zenith 750. I was stuck doing the wiring, and Dick saved me on more than one occasion, although I did still fry the electrical system once, just once.
Oh, just the battery, wasn't it? Backwards?
I
heard about that laughter. Yeah. No biggie. Yeah.
Their fault for not putting a diode in the system, but anyway.
That was great fun, finishing off the airplane, doing all the system stuff.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that. That was amazing.
Oh, that's cool. I remember you going over there. We were living together at the time, and I remember Tom would go over to work on the airplane, and that was exciting. It was cool to see it together. I'd help pull some rivets on it, but I wasn't going to touch wiring.
Well, as I recall, they had me build a new instrument panel one night, because the one we originally had didn't fit.
Oh, geez.
And then they were like, hey, why don't you just finish off the whole electrical system? I'm like, okay, I'll pick my way through it.
That's fantastic.
Well, that's one of those things, once you see it once, you've got it.
Right.
But walking into it cold is mystifying.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, we're so excited that you braved the cold to come up here. And so we always lead in with the question that I think we ask every guest, and it's always an interesting answer, is what first got you interested in wanting to fly?
Oh, that's an easy one. My father. My dad was a Navy pilot during World War II, flew Navy patrol bombers in the North Atlantic, the PB-4Y-1, which was a converted B-24. And then he stayed in the Navy reserves all through my youth. And so he would go down once a month and fly down to St. Louis and fly with the active reserves there. And so he always brought me back a little hand glider or something, and that got me started. And I've been an airplane nerd ever since. I remember I had girlfriends in high school that rejected me because I was playing with airplanes all the time, you know.
So. Well, they weren't,
I was able to make it into a full career. and I pinch myself, I can still do it today. You know, I'm very lucky.
Oh, that's awesome. How did your journey start flying?
Well, like I say, my father was a pilot, and he had come back to Purdue University on the GI Bill and got a degree in what they called air transportation, which was to allow him to run a small airport after World War II there. And with the whatever million plus pilots we'd trained, everybody assumed that everybody would have a car in a driveway and an airplane in a backyard. Well, the post-war recession hit and things didn't work out, and Dad went into another business. And but he was also trained as a flight instructor in those days, A&E mechanic. And so when I got old enough, I took – my father taught me how to fly, and which was neat. And then he taught my brother how to fly, and he taught my sister-in-law how to fly, you know, so it was a family thing. And that's how I got started. I ended up with a Navy scholarship in college at Purdue, and then from there went into Navy flight training, and that's where I really officially started flying. But I actually had flown before that.
What type of airplane were you being taught to fly in from your dad?
Oh, originally it was a Cessna 150, of course. You know, everybody learns in those things, I think. Yeah.
Still learning in them, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure. Easy to fly. So, and then when I went into the Navy, I flew initially the T-34, which is now considered a warbird. And I have three or four of them there. I live in Spruce Creek in Florida there, which is airport heaven. And I take care of three or four T-34s now. So, yeah.
they're following you around.
Yeah, yeah, yep.
Well, it is amazing how long those trainers stick around. I mean, you learned in a Cessna 150. I learned in a 152. You learned in a T-34 in the Navy. And my friend who's about my age was in one of the last T-34 classes. When he went through. So yeah.
Well, and later in my Navy career, I bought the T-6 that replaced the T-34s.
Yeah.
The T-34 Charlies. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So, funny how the wheel turns. Yeah.
So then from there, what was your next stop then for training? Would that have been the...
Well, I went through, again, through flight training in Pensacola and qualified for jets. So after the T-34, so I went up to Meridian, Mississippi, and I flew the T-2.
T-2, okay.
Primary trainer, straight wing trainer, and went through all the phases there of formation flying and instrument flying and all that sort of stuff. And then back down to Pensacola, where I did air-to-air gunnery and carrier qualifications in the T-2. And then from there to Kingsville, Texas, where I flew the F-9, with the swept wing version, the Cougar. Which interestingly, my father had flown back when he was on reserve duty. The same airplane, we were able to track it down one time.
Wow.
But, and the F-9, again, through the same basic syllabus, qualifying in the aircraft and then instrument qualifications and then all the tactical stuff, air-to-ground weapons and air-to-air gunnery and carrier qualifications and aerobatics and air combat maneuvering, all that kind of stuff, about 175 hours of flight time. And then from there, I was assigned to A6s.
Oh, wow! So you were A6s straight out of flight school, basically.
Yeah.
Did you qualify in the Lexington?
No, the Lexington was in work at the time, and in the F-9 I qualified off the Wasp.
Oh, wow!
Which the Wasp had hydraulic catapults, not the steam catapults. And the hydraulic catapult, you got all your acceleration in about the first 4 feet. It was like being a golf ball. compared to the steam catapults, which you got a much smoother acceleration.
Did I remember reading something about the F-9 where you actually, did you take off and land with the canopy open? Am I remembering that right?
In Korea, they did. By the time I flew it, they didn't.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool.
We had better Martin Baker ejection seats and they would go through the canopy. So you didn't have to open it. Yeah.
Wow. That's good.
But the airplane had a centrifugal flow engine and, it was power limited. So particularly in hot weather in South Texas in the summertime, which was very interesting. So we would take off, clean up, and the outbound initial, which was 5 miles out, you were hoping to get 250 knots. Hoping. Yeah.
Wow. That had to be quite a step when you're leaving the trainer going into the F-9. I mean, that is a legendary fighter. I mean, that was arguably the true, the first the F-9, the Panther was, of course, the first, what I would say, true jet Navy fighter that was really out there.
Yeah, there were two or three in that phase, but it was one of the early ones, yeah.
Yeah.
And, of course, made by Grumman, and that's where they got their reputation for the Grumman Ironworks.
Yeah.
More than once, I thought I'd broken the airplane, and it protected me. But, yeah.
Wow. What did it handle like?
The two-seaters were a training airplane. The single-seaters, you could see a marked improvement in pitch response and the airplane would turn on a dime. I was in the last F-9 class coming into Kingsville, Texas, and they shut down for a couple of months and retrained the instructors in the TA-4. And the TA-4, which is considered a turning airplane today, we could turn inside of them all day long. So if we were fighting the A-4s, they would work the vertical and we'd work the horizontal. Today, the A-4s, well, they're not around anymore, but when they were, they would work the horizontal, and the F-4s and F-14s would work the vertical. So it's interesting how things evolve and change.
Wow, that is cool. That is awesome. It's hard to believe the Cougar or the Panther hung on that long.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Yeah. I think one of the turning points there, by the way, we had 4 20-millimeter cannons in the nose of the airplane, and one of the exercises we did was air-to-ground weapons. And we got to shoot the cannons at derelicts out in the desert. And the gun butts were right next to your knees. So it was very obvious when you were shooting. And that was one of the most fun and exciting things I think I've ever done. There were guys that actually came back with ammunition. I never did. And that was one of the reasons why I decided to become an attack pilot, because it was a whole lot more interesting than doing air combat maneuvering, I thought. So that was that was one of my inspirations.
So the... You go from the training aircraft that we just mentioned here to the A6.
Mm-hmm.
What was your first impression of the A6 when you walked up to it that first time you're going to go up in it?
It was huge. It was a big airplane. 65,000 pounds maximum. Well, 62.5, I guess, something like that. Huge airplane. By comparison, the latest F-18s are about 60,000 pounds.
Wow.
You know, so, and A6 was an amazing airplane. My initial flight in it, let me back up. Of course, the Navy wouldn't let me go out and fly anything without going through the ground training and the simulators and all that kind of stuff to prepare me. So I wasn't going out cold. But my first flight, I took off and rode in the right seat with an instructor pilot in the left seat. There's no controls on the right seat, by the way, at all. And I just rode around for, 45 minutes, and he demonstrated the airplane. And we were over on the other side of the Olympic Peninsula. So for fun, he dropped down and flew up one of the mountain valleys there and on the Olympic Peninsula and popped over into Whidbey Island. And then we swapped seats. And I went out and did the same thing. And when I was done with my basic air work stuff, I dropped down low level and flew up through one of the mountain valleys. I mean, he did it. I did it, 300 feet at 500 knots. It was easy. and the guy kind of tapped me on the knee and says, a little higher until you get some more experience. Yes, sir. But the airplane was very forgiving in that. It was an easy airplane to fly, as most of our new airplanes are. So I think the easiest airplane I ever flew was the F-18. With the fly-by-wire flight control system, it was easy. It solved all of the problems. So we keep getting better on the design of the airplane so we can use them for other things and do other things while we're doing it.
Wow.
So, yeah.
So can you walk me through taking your first cat shot in the A6?
Okay. Well, as most of the airplanes of the day, even today, you don't hold on to the stick. I held my hand in a U in my crotch, and of course go to full power with the left hand on the throttles. And there's a bar there that drops down you can hold on to. And when you get the shot, the stick floats back and nests in your hand, and you just catch it. And the airplane naturally goes off the catapult better that way than if you try to fly it off. Wow. And it's about, I don't know, 3 seconds, 3.5 seconds, and you're there. And there's nothing you can do about it. I mean, brakes on, brakes off, doesn't make any difference. It just goes. And the airplane was very easy on the catapult shot. Perhaps back up a little bit on the A6. A6 was designed as a long-distance, subsonic, heavy weapons carrier. It was actually came out of a specification from Korean War where the Marines wanted an all-weather close-air support airplane. And that designated the system that was on the A6, but the airframe itself was designed to haul a big load a long distance subsonically. And you, if you look at a picture of it, the big fat nose, which held the huge radar, you could get up about 560 or 70 knots. If pointed straight down, you just wouldn't go any faster. But you could put 22 500 pounders on the airplane and fly at 550 knots straight and level all day long. So it was an amazing airplane that way.
Did it come from sort of the, not necessarily the family lineage, but maybe the result of like the aircraft, like the Sky Knights that were flying in Korea? Was that something that kind of was in that family of?
Could have been, yeah. They never actually attributed a direct line there, but yeah. Again, the really neat thing about the A6 was it had the system in it. They called it DIAN, which stood for Digitally Integrated Attack Navigation Equipment. It was the first airplane to have a digital computer that tied together all the systems in the aircraft. So we had an incredible long-range radar. We had a track radar. We had inertial navigation. We had Doppler. There was a couple more things in there I'm forgetting. And they all were tied together with a digital computer on like a multiplex bus. And this is, we're talking 1958 technology when it was designed. It had 22 boxes that made all that stuff dance and sing. And the computer was a drum-type computer, was between the bombardier navigator's legs. And if it jammed up on a catapult shot, the technique was to kick it on the left side. And it would break it free and it'd start working again. And it had 20K of memory. K of memory.
Wow.
Okay. And when we were flying around, it would solve the navigation solution once a second. And when we went into attack mode, it would drop a whole bunch of other functions and it solved the attack sequence 5 times a second. So it would literally tell me where to fly the airplane to drop the bomb. We all see the old Norden bomb sight thing from World War II. This thing was all automated. So the bombardier navigator could designate a target and designate the weapon. And all I did was fly a steering box. And if I kept it in the center, the bomb came off and hit the target.
Wow.
It was way, way, way ahead of everything else in technology. And hence very unique that way. And the bombardier navigator who sat to my right, his seat was actually, I think, 4 inches lower and 4 inches back or something like that. But he worked that system and needed to.
Wow.
Back to the radar, it was an incredible radar. It was a Ku band, 14 gigahertz. And that radar could look out 100 miles and see windows on a building.
Wow.
Wow.
I mean, and we had multiple modes it could go through. We could go into an expanded mode where we looked at that building from 100 miles away and filled the screen. We also had what they called AMTI mode, automatic moving target indicator, AMTI. So we could switch over to that mode and it would show us anything that was moving, trucks, trains, cars, things like that, which was very handy in Vietnam, working on the trails and the rail lines up north and things. So it was an incredible radar. And then I also had a track radar that I could designate and it would lock onto a spot and it could also give me a bombing solution. So most of our, we also practiced visual dive bombing endlessly. That was our specialty, of course. But whenever the weather was marginal or bad, we always went to the system.
It's incredible. Airplane was way ahead of its time.
Yes, yes, yeah.
Than I thought.
And somewhat misunderstood. And they only built, I don't know, built 350 of them, something like that. There weren't that many.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess a couple questions on the radar as you're talking about that. So, like, could the radar, could you like, correct the INS off of terrain features you're seeing on the radar?
Oh, yeah, for sure. For wow. sure. Yeah. Yeah, as soon as we would launch in Vietnam, and got a little altitude, the bombardier navigator would pick out a point of land that we were familiar with,
yeah.
designate that, and that would update our position on the inertial because the ship's inertial never was right. and actually, when we came back then, we would tell the ship where it was.
That's great. That's great. And then the other question I had was, so you mentioned dive bombing visually. Was that really the only way to do it? Kind of like a dive toss mode off of the gun sight or manual depression, or could you level bomb visually as well?
Well, level bombing you couldn't see,
right?
Unless you were really low altitude. And I had one mission that was special that way. That we practiced. One of our primary missions, of course, was nuclear war, and we had various deliveries for the nuclear bombs.
Mm-hmm.
And the nuclear bombs, you toss them. Because you wanted to be as far away as possible when they went off.
Right.
But the one of the backup modes is what they call a laydown delivery, where you actually flew right over the target at a couple hundred feet and dropped the bomb manually, and then it had a delay fuse on it.
You hope.
Fortunately, we never got to test those things.
Yeah.
but we used those same techniques with iron bombs in North Vietnam, of course.
Oh, well, okay.
Yeah.
Before we continue, we'd like to take a minute to thank our sponsor, Crew Chief Systems. Are you still relying on paper logs or manual spreadsheets to manage your aircraft? It's time to elevate your approach. Crew Chief Systems puts your airplane at the center of real-time aircraft asset intelligence, allowing you to fly safer, save time, and protect your aircraft's value. Crew Chief's intuitive platform unifies all of your maintenance, compliance, and operational data, giving you instant access to your aircraft's full history, upcoming requirements, and real-time insights directly from your mobile device or computer. Whether you're a pilot, fleet manager, or mechanic, Crew Chief Systems helps you stay compliant, make smarter decisions, and keep your aircraft in peak condition. Visit crewchiefsystems.com to see how you can modernize your aircraft management. And as a special thank you to Green Dot listeners, save 15% for the lifetime of your Crew Chief GA subscription when you use the coupon code GREEN15, that's GREEN15, at crewchiefsystems.com. Thanks again to Crew Chief Systems for sponsoring the Green Dot.
So we're working our way toward Vietnam. As you get checked out in the A6, how long was it before you get checked out in the airplane and then you deploy to Vietnam?
Well, it turned out that I was assigned to a squadron that was just coming back from deployment. So they were on about a year turnaround, which gave me lots of time to get lots of experience flying the plane before we actually deployed. I had, 300 or 400 hours of experience in the airplane before we went. There were other circumstances. We had guys join the squadron the week after we left, that kind of thing. So it could happen any way that it just happened to be. they tried to get you in early so you could get the training and get used to working with everybody. But I had very adequate training before I went.
Wow. Can you walk me through that the first mission you flew in theater and
in Vietnam? Yeah. Well, first of all, my squadron was a fairly large squadron. We had 22 crews. I was rocket 13. I was the 13th crew in seniority. And so I got assigned to a senior officer, a lieutenant commander, who had previous experience. I was his wingman initially. Well, the very first mission I had, which was over South Vietnam, actually up in the backside of South Vietnam and North Vietnam area called Mugia Pass, the lead airplane went down on the catapult. They couldn't launch. So I went off by myself. And the weather was crappy, so the entire air wing joined on me. And we did a systems radar drop with me being the lead with 20 airplanes around me.
Wow.
That was my first mission. So welcome to the war. You're in it.
And, did you at least have I know usually they pair like an experienced navigator with a rookie pilot.
No. My navigator was junior to me.
Okay. I guess that's a newer thing.
Yeah. No, there weren't enough to go around. So, okay. And the experienced navigators didn't want to fly with the rookie pilots. I mean,
that's fair enough. I get that.
Yeah, and again, the training was excellent, and we did it, obviously.
Wow. Can you talk about, like, what kind of targets would you guys go after? What was a normal kind of target?
Well, I went to Vietnam in 71 and 72, which were the last 2 years, basically, of the war, you know, of the North War, or the war. And then my first cruise, there was a bombing halt in North Vietnam. So we did mostly support work in South Vietnam and other countries we don't talk about. Close air support type stuff and interdiction stuff on the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And then at night, so that was in the daytime, usually with a forward air controller, and they would designate a target and we were doing visual dive bombing. One of those, we normally carried 22 500 pounders. We also did the night missions to do the interdiction on the Ho Chi Minh Trail. There were various versions. We had what they called Commando Bolt, which was, there were designated radar points, and they would give us an offset from that. The system could designate a mountaintop, if you wish, or a hook in the river, and then you could say, I want the bombs to drop 2,027 feet to the, you know, on a heading of 060 from that point, and the system would send the bombs over there. So we would on Commando Bolts, they would designate a target for us and a time. And then we also did what they call Bolt Charger, which was if they had moving targets, they would designate an area to go into, and we'd switch to the AMTI mode and look for the moving targets. And we carried a mixture of, we carried 10 Rockeye bombs, which were a bomblet type of thing. It was a cluster bomb. And the idea was we dropped those and they would stop and hopefully hit something and cause a fire. And we also carried another 12 500 pounders. And those, we come back around and make the second pass with those, hopefully on the burning first pass target area. So that was most of my first cruise, was those kinds of missions, day and night.
Was it the Charlie model that had the FLIR for night bombing?
Yeah, the A6 Charlies. They actually just came out at the end of the war, and they had very little use, actually. And the problem, Southeast Asia was so much moisture in the air and the hazing, and the technology of the day, they had a laser spot guidance, and they actually, the low light level TV was better than the FLIR in those days. So it was a low light level TV system.
Okay. Huh.
Later, they got much better versions of FLIR, and things changed. But yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the A6 Charlies were an interim thing. Yeah. They eventually, all that technology got rolled into the eventual A6E, which had a bubble turret up on the under the bottom of the nose that incorporated all the technology from the Charlies. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm nerding out a lot over the A6, and for our audience, I think I used a acronym there, forward-looking infrared FLIR.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah.
So I'm nerding out as well on the A6, but for, I'm sure Tom, we'll get into, you're learning DCS type stuff. I'm geeking out because of Flight of the Intruder stuff, which we'll talk about here in just a bit. But did you ever, did you have a mission that really stands out for you, over the rest of them? Was there one that you look back on and think, man, that's a story to tell.
Well, yeah, there were several ones. When we went back, well, let me back up. I flew the also the A6B, which was the standard arm or wild weasel version, if you wish. And the Navy had, again, a long-range plan to build a super good airplane to do that, but it was taking too long, so they handmade some special airplanes for us. And there were, I think the total run of the A6Bs was 19, and we had three of them at one point. And there were different mods. They built, you know, blocks of them. So we had the final block of what they call mod 0/1. And we would go out and try to get the bad guys to illuminate us with a radar. And then we would hopefully hose them down with a missile before they had a chance to shoot us. And I was flying one of those missions at the right at the end of the first cruise. It was up over Magia Pass. And I covered the strike group going in, and they left. And I looked out, and I saw this beautiful waterfall on the friendly side of the border. And so we actually turned north. Everybody else had left, and we turned north, and we were looking at the countryside. We were sightseeing. You know, it was our last flight of the cruise. No big deal. And we got up about adjacent to Vinh, the North Vietnamese city of Vinh, and we got illuminated with radars. And the special guidance tones came on that said they actually had live missiles coming at us. And I had we carried two Shrike and two standard arm missiles. The Shrike were converted AIM 9s. They had about a 500 pound missile, and the standard arms were a 1400 pound missile. And when I had a Shrike selected, so I just, and the Shrike, you had to kind of loft them into position. So I turned toward the signal, jerked the nose up to my best guess, and fired the missile. And ended a split S as the first surface-to-air missile went by us. SAM went by, and the second one came by and exploded behind us. But my bombardier navigator had never been on an airplane that fired a missile. So he heard the rush of the rocket motor, and then my violent maneuver, he thought we were hit. So he's over in the right seat groping for the ejection handles as I'm diving for the ground trying to get away, beating him with my right hand trying to keep him from ejecting in a perfectly good airplane. And we got down below the mountains where they couldn't see us, and we were shooting out to the south and popped up, and, you know, perspiration's starting to dry up. And he says, "Hey, we got three more missiles. Let's go back." And I said, "You're nuts." You know? I said, this is significant because we were fired on. We were not doing anything, and we were in a, you know, safe territory, and we were fired on illegally. I said, this is politically significant. We need to report this. So I said, send an encoded message to the Airborne Command Center, which in our case was called Black Eagle. And so he sits over there and does the encoder, you know, the digits, the words get converted to letters and things. And he sends this thing over to the Black Eagle. And there's a pause, as you can tell, the time it would take him to decode it. The guy comes back up over there. "Were you just shot at by a missile?" "Yes." "Okay." You know, so much for coding. We got back to the ship, and, you know, interesting debrief. That incident led to the retaliatory strikes by the Air Force, which led to the rebombing of North Vietnam.
Oh, wow. Jeez.
Which led to a congressional investigation, which led to the general that was in charge of the Air Force that started that retiring early. And as was the tradition at the time, he retired they gave him a kicker of a disability. Well, he went from full flight pay to a disability overnight, and that led to the revamping of all the flight pay systems.
Wow.
In the military, where they don't pay senior officers anymore for flying when they're not flying. So it was a monumental mission.
Wow.
It was just coincidental at the last time, you know, we were out there just sightseeing.
Wow.
So, anyway, that was a fun one. I have one other story I'd like to tell if I might. This is, we came back to Vietnam. We did a quick turnaround this time, four and a half months, and we were back instead of the year and a half plus at the previous cycle. And shortly after we were there, a mission tasking came down. The North Vietnamese had moved missile-firing PT boats into the Hangay area, up in the northern parts of Vietnam area, where the shoreline runs east and west. And you've all seen these karst ridges, the vertical mountains that go, or little islands that go straight down into the ocean. Well, we got tasked, special mission from the Joint Chiefs of Staff to to take out these PT boats. And unfortunately, the day that they chose to do that was about a 300-foot overcast in that area. And we launched with several airplanes, and nobody else could get down through. And my bombardier navigator says, I think I can pick us through the rocks and get us down there. And I said, go for it. So he talked me down below the 300-foot ceiling amongst the islands. And we found the PT boat, and we sank it. We made four runs. The first one was to identify it. And then the second one, I dropped half the ordnance. The third one was the other half of the ordnance. And the fourth one was to take pictures. And meanwhile, they're shooting out. You know, it's just like out of World War II, the puffs of smoke around us and the missiles going overhead and all that kind of stuff. And we got back to the ship, and they wanted to give me a Medal of Honor for the mission. And then it discovered that they'd forgotten to put film in the camera, so there was no proof.
Oh, jeez.
And they couldn't get back to the area until the fog cleared, and which was the next day, and there was nothing there. Well, it sank. They couldn't find the boat, but, you know, so that was probably my hairiest mission, and I ended up with a Distinguished Flying Cross for that one.
Holy cow.
Wow.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Wow.
But we did that kind of stuff all the time, and we stopped putting in things for awards because it wasn't done, you know. It was just, we were doing our jobs.
Wow. How many missions did you fly total, do you know?
147.
Wow. That's incredible.
And never took a scratch.
Wow. Wow.
Contrary to the way it was being presented back in the States here. We lost one airplane. It was our executive officer. And two nights before, he and I were flying together into, well, we had the same target at the same time. We weren't flying in formation. We were hitting a MiG field. It was at the head of a valley. The valley went in and turned kind of a 90-degree left turn and then a 90-degree right turn. And in that, between those two turns was the MiG field along the side of the river. And so we would come in the way I attacked it, we came in way over to the right on the valley and then turned, so we had a fairly long run-in of 5 or 6 miles so the bombardier navigator could get everything stabilized. And we were carrying 1,000-pounders. We carried 12 1,000-pounders. And the 1,000-pounders, you had to go up to 2,000 feet to drop them. Otherwise, the explosion would blow yourself out of the air. Yeah. So when I made the turn, 1,000 guns lit up. It was the most spectacular anti-aircraft fire I've ever seen in my life. Light show, anything like that. It was incredible. And, you know, all the different anti-aircraft guns had different colors. So there's purple balls here, and there's green ones there, and there's red ones over there, and you look at it, and you say, I can't fly through that. Well, it's like looking at a woods. You always see the tree trunks, but when you get up there, there's separation between them, and you can run into the woods by just dodging a little bit. Well, that's what we did. We picked our way through the end. These guys were all barrage firing. They were just shooting straight up, basically. Through, hit our target, went out. My executive officer coming behind me saw all this and turned away. He didn't think he could do it. So he's talking to me afterwards. And I said, yeah, this is the way we do it. You know, the trees analogy and things like that. So two nights later, he's flying up in a target north of Hanoi. And the coast in spot he picked was a huge concentration of anti-aircraft fire. And I said, XO, you need to go around that. You need to go over here or over there. He says, well, they won't expect me to go right through the middle. I said, XO, go around it, you know. Well, he went right through the middle of it, and he got the random hit and punched out, and he and the bombardier navigator were POWs for about 3 months, and they came home.
Wow.
So that was our only loss on the cruise out of 22 crews, and I might say, by the way, that last few months of Vietnam, when B-52s went into the north and such, the weather was so crappy, they downloaded the fighters and some of the light attack aircraft. And they augmented us. We at one point had almost 30 airplanes. So that's why I was flying two or three missions a day.
Wow. What squadrons were you in? Were you in more than one, or was it one?
Well, I did all my A6 time was in VA-196, which is has the black ace of spades with the orange devil on it. It's featured in, you mentioned Flight of the Intruder earlier, based on the same squadron. Steve Kuntz, the author, was in my squadron. So a good friend, as a matter of fact. But I was just in that one squadron.
So you mentioned Flight of the Intruder, and everybody knows I'm a nerd about movies and things like that. So I got to ask, you know, what did you think of the movie overall?
Well, I thought the book was excellent. The movie was less than excellent. And that's, you know, it just didn't work that very well for whatever reason. The book, Steve is, I think, one of the best writers today of what it's like to fly. If you really want to find out how, you know, what the pilot feels like, read some of the stuff he's done. It's excellent. And he very cleverly took the stories that had happened all through the A6 community and collaged them together to one fictional character and embellished them as appropriate and made a story out of it, which was excellent. But I actually know the background for every one of those scenes. The opening scene in the movie, for instance, where the bombardier navigator gets shot in the neck, that happened to our sister squadron on the Midway, I believe. And my bombardier navigator ended up marrying the widow.
Wow.
There's a chapter in there where the guy shuts down both engines over North Vietnam. That was me. Now, nothing like it ended up being written up, but we were flying an A6B dodging SAMs, and if you could see the SAM coming from you out in front, that version of the surface-to-air missiles were designed for high-altitude bombers. They could not maneuver very well, and we could literally maneuver around them. And I'll give you the analogy. If we went out here in the parking lot and stood 50, 60 feet apart and you threw a baseball at me, I could dodge it. And if you threw multiple baseballs at me, if I saw them coming, I could dodge them. Now, if you start throwing them from behind me and around, you know, that starts getting a little trickier. And that's what the North Vietnamese started doing, of course. And we had two or three SAMs in front of us that we dodged, and then we had one coming at about our 5 o'clock position. And particularly in the A6, where I was sitting offset to the left trying to see back at 5 o'clock, was really hard. So I was strained up in my ejection seat, twisted, and I was looking for leverage, and I pushed on the throttles, and I just pushed a little too hard. Pushed them around a horn, both engines started to unwind. I hit the relights immediately, brought them back around. One engine wound down to flight idle and right back up. Nothing, the generators, everything stayed online. Nothing happened. The other engine went down far enough that the generators kicked off for maybe 3 or 4 seconds, and then it wound up also. That was it. That was the incident. I told the bombardier navigator, I said, if you tell anybody that I shut both engines down over North Vietnam, I'm going to, you know, we'll have a little talk on the side here. And of course, we're 5 minutes into debrief, and he's yelling at the next debrief counter, we shut both engines down over North Vietnam. And that, again, that was what led to the chapter, which with a whole lot more embellishment and good writing became part of the book. But I read the entire book one evening because I couldn't put it down.
It's an amazing book. And anybody listening that's looking for a good read, Flight of the Intruder or the whole any of the books in that series are wonderful.
Well, the second book is Grafton is flying F-14s in the Western or Eastern Mediterranean against Hakim the terrorist. That one's okay.
Yeah.
The third one is the Minotaur, where Grafton is a program manager in Washington. Steve actually came and lived with me for a while and went to work with me. I was a program manager in Washington.
Oh, wow.
and then the fourth book, whose title I forget right now, the bad guy is discovered in the fourth book because he gives a false address, and Steve used my address as the false address.
That's awesome.
My wife is actually credited in there on the Minotaur with proofing the book. She had been a long-term employee at Naval Air Systems Command. And knew everybody and knew everything, so she proofed the book to make sure it was all technically accurate. Accurate from the standpoint of how we actually worked. So, yeah.
So I've got to ask, as we're talking about some of the stories are, you know, based off real people, please tell me the character of Cole Virgil Cole is based off of a real person.
Maybe bits and pieces. he collaged together lots of different people. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And there was always the joke about Bob My Smoke, you know.
Yeah.
But that was just in the traditions of the thing. And I think one thing that he captured in the book and maybe in the movie too, again, my first cruise was we were making little rocks out of big rocks on the Ho Chi Minh Trail and being shot at in the process. And morale, I wouldn't say was bad, but it wasn't high. When we went back to the second cruise, when we went back into North Vietnam to get the job done, morale increased. It went sky high because it felt like we were actually doing our jobs. And I found a lot of civilians didn't understand that at all. They said, weren't you scared? No, we weren't scared at all. We were actually happy to be going going and doing the thing like we should have been doing it from the beginning.
Yeah. So, anyway. Well, this is awesome. I know we're fighting the clock. Tom, did you have any last comments?
Actually, directed at you. I think Virgil Cole is probably he's probably based on Willem Dafoe. I'm not even sure he was acting.
I think it's just Willem Dafoe. Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe so. Maybe so. Yeah.
No,
yeah.
But Dick, I mean, we've if you're ever back in town, I mean, it sounds like we need to do a part two because we've barely scratched the surface. Yeah. You mentioned Hornets. We haven't talked about that. Obviously, your entire GA flying career and everything else. We'd love to.
I think we definitely need a part two the next time. Yeah.
Well, I ended up spending 25 years in the Navy, and at the end of Vietnam, there, while I was actually over in finishing up the war there, my detailer came and says, "Hey, you've been designated to be the training officer for the A6E introduction, and you're going to go back to Oceania and fly the A6E and bring it to the West Coast, and you'll be deploying with the first squadron, and you might as well build a house here because you're going to be in." On Whidbey Island for the next 6 years. I said, great, that fits my, just what I want to do. 2 weeks later, I got orders to graduate school and in Monterey. And it was kind of, and I decided to go to Monterey. And while I was there, I requested and was picked up early for a special program. There were never more than about 300 of us in the Navy. I became what they call an aeronautical engineering duty officer. And the best way I described that, I was Mr. Spock. science, and I did science, technology, industry interface, and I went on to do a whole bunch of really weird stuff. I was a single guy. I was easy to move. I enjoyed doing new jobs, so I have a whole bunch of sea stories that I can tell if you'd like to try this again.
That would be amazing.
Oh, absolutely. That'd be awesome. Yep. We're going to schedule part two.
Okay.
Well, thank you again for coming out to be part of our speaker series. Looking forward to having you tell some of these stories on stage with me tonight, so... we're looking forward to all of that. Thank you to all of our listeners that keep listening and keep those wonderful comments coming. We appreciate all the feedback. And we will catch you next time when we're cleared to land on the Green Dot.